This podcast was brought to you by withaim.co.
Welcome back to Vanishing Shadows. In the last episode,
I'm about to open the journal when a heavy knock at the door shatters the silence. My pulse pounding in my ears is louder than the knuckles on the wood. I freeze, waiting for the word, police. But there is silence. And then another knock. Insistent. Menacing. This is not just a friend, a landlord, a delivery person. It is someone looking for Jesse. Or looking for me. With the notebook in hand, I scurry back to the kitchen. As quietly as I can, I climb onto the countertop, bruising my shins on the sharp formica edge, and scramble out through the window. The internet cafe is dim, grimy, and familiar. It may not have been smart to return to a venue I'd previously visited, but it felt safer than driving around, searching. I'm almost sure I haven't been followed. No one seems to be on my tail. Not yet, anyway. And I know this place. I know they accept cash. I know the customers keep to themselves, mind their own business. People use a public computer for a myriad of reasons, not all of them legitimate. I sit at the same desk as I did the last time I was here. My fingers touch the smooth outline of the Social Security card in my pocket as the computer boots up. The PC is old, slow, and cheap. When it is finally ready, I check the Seattle Police online blotter. There are a handful of crimes reported. A carjacking in Tukwila. A Renton domestic incident where a woman shot her partner in the leg. Two men arrested with drugs and guns after a traffic stop. But there is no report of a man stabbed to death in a luxury home northwest of the city. Surely by now, Hazel has come home, seen the body, called the police. Unless she didn't call them. Unless she didn't want the police to know that her lover had been murdered in her own home. But why? Was I meant to find my boyfriend's body? Was I meant to go down for the crime? If so, why would she leave me the money and the plane ticket? Shaking my head to dislodge the swirling suspicions, I type in the name Carter Douglas Sumner. The results load slowly, and I feel my pulse quicken. Who is this man? And why did Jesse have his identification? The only possibilities I can fathom are shady, illegal, even nefarious. But speculation is pointless. Soon I will know the truth. The screen displays a handful of news articles, all variations on the same headline from 2016. Brothers charged in violent home invasion. Home invasion gone wrong lands brothers in jail. Pillar of the community badly beaten in home invasion robbery. Is Carter Sumner the villain or the victim? Did Jesse hurt him and steal his ID? Or does Carter have something to do with Jesse's murder? And what does Hazel know about this man? I click on the first article and read. Two brothers face numerous charges after a breaking and entering on Mercer Island turned violent. The stately home on Ferncroft Road was broken into around 10:40 p.m. on July 25th. Two men entered the residence by breaking a basement window and proceeded to steal several thousand dollars worth of jewelry and electronics. Before the intruders could flee, the homeowners, Donald Fryer, 64, and his wife, Sunny Fryer, 59, returned home from a social engagement. Mr. Fryer was attacked upon entering his home and sustained serious injuries. Mrs. Fryer was bound at the wrists and ankles and locked in a closet while her husband continued to be brutalized. Donald Fryer was admitted to the hospital and remains in a medically induced coma. Doctors say his injuries are life-altering. Several days later, after reviewing surveillance footage and interviewing Sunny Fryer, police arrested two brothers for the crime. Sean Reginald Sumner, 29, and Carter Douglas Sumner, 25. Were found in Othello and taken into custody by Seattle police. The Sumner brothers have been charged with breaking and entering, false imprisonment, theft under $5,000, and assault causing bodily harm. Sean Sumner has known ties to gangs and the drug trade. Carter Sumner has no record but is known to police. I feel no surprise that Carter Sumner is a criminal. Was he a friend of Jesse's? Did Hazel know him too? Or was he a victim, just like I was? Another target of one of their plots. I try searching Carter Sumner and Jesse Thomas together, but Jesse's name does not appear with the other man's. I add Hazel Laval to the search, but nothing new shows up. Hazel's name is associated with a few charity events. A gala fundraiser for breast cancer and a fashion show for children's literacy. She is a society wife, just like she told me she was. So I go back to the second article about the Sumner brothers and read through it. The information is virtually the same. But about halfway through the piece, there's a photograph. It was taken from a distance. There are a number of squad cars in the foreground, and a suburban street forms the backdrop. Several heavily armed police officers escort the two brothers away from a stucco bungalow. Their hands are cuffed behind their backs. Their expressions are stony. The Sumner brothers are big men with broad muscle shoulders and thick necks. But the similarities end there. The older brother, Sean, is closer to the camera. His dark hair is cut short, and even from a distance, I can see that his eyes are a steely blue against his swarthy complexion. Notably, his nose appears to have been broken more than once. The younger brother is farther away, but his hair is lighter, his lips fuller, his nose aquiline. Though it is impossible to see in the photograph, I know his eyes are hazel with flecks of gold. Because Carter Sumner is Jesse. Or more correctly, Jesse is Carter Sumner. The discovery doesn't shock me. In fact, I feel nothing as I stare at my lover's image. The cold look in his eyes, the hard set of his jaw, the slight sneer on his lips. Jesse was a thief. He broke into a couple's home and beat them brutally. My boyfriend was a violent criminal. His arrest is the final piece of the puzzle, clicking into place. On some level, I knew. Not the details, of course, but the fact that Jesse's past was shady. I'd never asked about his bare apartment, his stick-and-poke tattoos, the car he surely couldn't afford. I didn't question him about his history because I had secrets too. Parts of myself I wanted to hide. And so I gave him the benefit of the doubt. Hazel too. And now I am paying for that blind trust. I look at the photo again. These two handcuffed men being taken away. I know Carter Sumner is dead. But where is his brother Sean? And what does he know? He is my only link to the man I thought I knew. The man I cared about. Only Sean Sumner can give me the answers I seek. I drive south toward a strip of cheap motels and all-night diners. The sun is low now, and the tall signs are lit, advertising all-day breakfast, free Wi-Fi, and adult channels. With the bag full of money, I could afford to stay somewhere decent, even luxurious. But without a credit card for incidentals, my options are seriously limited, and I need to keep a low profile. I am on the Laval security camera walking into the scene of a crime. My footprints and fingerprints are there, stamped in blood. I look guilty, just like Hazel wanted. The exit that would take me to Uncle Jack's diner looms ahead and elicits a pang of remorse. I was supposed to work today at 4. What did my boss Randy think when I didn't show up? I'd been consistently reliable, but he wouldn't be surprised. I worked for cash under the table. He wouldn't expect a written letter of my resignation or 2 weeks' notice. And he owes me money for my last paycheck. Maybe he's glad I up and vanished. I think about the day that Jesse came into the diner, sat down at the bar. His presence had thrilled me. He had sought me out after our garage encounter, and I was flattered. But now I wonder, did he have another motive for finding me? Was it all part of his and Hazel's twisted plan? It comes to me then. A quick flash of memory. Randy and Jesse exchanging a few muttered words. At the time, I'd assumed it was a simple customer interaction, but I'd noted the tense familiarity between them. Did Randy know Jesse? Or more correctly, Carter Sumner? The night when Jesse and I made love up against my car. Fucked. In the alley behind the restaurant. Vincent had suddenly appeared when we were done. Or had he been watching the whole time? Had Jesse told him what we were going to do? Was it some sort of sick game? I am paranoid, suspecting everyone. But why wouldn't I? Hazel was my only friend. I had believed Jesse and I had something promising and real. But all along, they were playing me. 5 minutes later, I pull off I-5 and into a largely vacant parking lot. The Horseshoe Motel is set back from the highway, nestled behind a pancake restaurant and a bowling alley. The list of amenities is displayed on the overhead sign. Ice machine, free Wi-Fi, business center. Access to a computer could be helpful. A fan whirs as I enter the small office. The cloying scent of an air freshener no match for the odor of cigarettes and fast food. A middle-aged woman sits behind the counter with a book of Sudoku puzzles. She looks up when I enter, her expression mildly annoyed. I need a room, please. Reservation? The place appears deserted. The vacancy sign is on. No. She heaves a sigh like this is a major inconvenience, and not her actual job. She sets the puzzle book down with a smack. I pay cash up front, and leave an extra $100 as a security deposit. I will collect it when I check out. How many nights? She asks me. One for now, I say, because I know I should leave. I should get on a plane and get the hell out of here. But not before I talk to Sean Sumner. I'll pay you in the morning if I decide to stay on. This seems to irritate her further, but she slides the key across the scratched countertop and returns to her puzzle book. The first thing I do when I enter the hotel room is shove the strawberry-scented air freshener into a dresser drawer. I press my index fingers into my eyebrows, hoping the chemical scent is responsible for my headache. But it is likely a combination of stress, fear, and grief. Not for the death of Carter Sumner, but for the demise of Jesse Thomas, a man who had never even existed. My car is concealed by a dumpster behind the bowling alley. If the police or someone else are looking for me, I don't want them spotting it parked out front. I had lugged my backpack full of clothing and toiletries to the end unit, along with a canvas bag containing my most precious items, my new passport, the money, and Jesse's notebook. As I head to the shower, I bring it into the bathroom for safekeeping. The tub has rust stains, but the water pressure is good. I let it pummel my skull, hoping to wash away the anxiety and confusion gripping my head like a vice. Tomorrow, I hope to get some clarity. Because tomorrow, I'm going to speak to Sean Sumner, Department of Corrections inmate number 62124. Before today, I had never searched for an inmate. I'd had no reason to. It was far easier than I had anticipated. The Washington State Department of Corrections has a comprehensive site. I typed Sean Sumner into their search engine, and it provided all the details I needed. Clicking on the name of the jail or institution even provided an address and a map. Next to each inmate's name was a link. Register to be notified of release. It sent a chill through me. Had Donald and Sonny Fryer received a warning when Jesse was released from prison? Had they hired security and lived in fear that he might come after them again? And now their other abuser is out in the community, too. Sean Sumner is on a work release program, housed in a 20-bed halfway house in Bellingham. No bars, no locks, no guards. Turning off the water, I dry myself with a threadbare towel and wrap another one around my hair. I have slept in my clothes for so long that donning a clean but wrinkled t-shirt and fresh underpants feels like a luxury. Tearing off the bedspread, I climb into worn sheets. It is a real bed at least, but I won't sleep. Tomorrow is too pivotal, and I can't be sure that I am safe here. That someone isn't going to kick this door in at any moment. But I can't spend the night in my car. Not without my knife. I dig Jesse's journal out of the canvas bag and remove the pen clipped to the cover. Since I took the notebook from his apartment, I've been eager to sift through it. To find some clue as to who he really was and why he is dead. Sitting cross-legged, I open the book in my lap. The first page has a name at the top. Stephen. And then a series of letters and numbers. Try. EX 3 sets of 6, dash 8, 25. KB 3 sets of 8, dash 10, 25. By. Curl 3 sets of 8, dash 10, 25. Shoulders. They are workouts. Sets, reps, weights for his clients. There are pages of them. Nothing valuable or interesting. I turn to a page with an H at the top. Does it stand for Hazel? The workout makes sense. Light weights, lots of reps, the focus on butt and abs. I am about to toss the notebook aside when I spot something. In the top corner of the page, in a tiny scrawl, is a number. 206. It's the area code for Seattle. I flip through the journal, searching for further digits. Several pages later, I find 4 more numbers in the same precise handwriting. And then, on the inside back cover, 3. It's a phone number. It has to be. Jesse had been afraid to keep the number stored in his phone, and he didn't want to write it down in sequence, in case someone found it. But the area code gives it away. If I dial it, who will answer? It's not Hazel's number. Who was Jesse calling? I grab the hotel phone and punch in star 67 to block the caller ID. My mouth is dry, my pulse pounding in my temple as I listen to it ring. Once, twice, 3 and then 4 times.
Hello?
It is a man's voice, cool and deep. It sends a shudder through me. Do I ask who is speaking? Pretend I got a wrong number? But before I can say another word, the man speaks again. His voice is cold and mechanical.
Lee, is that you?
The phone slips in my hand as fear grips my throat. Who have I called? How does he know me? The voice travels from the receiver now pressed to my chest.
Tell me where you are.
I slam the handset into the cradle. Rain spatters the windshield, and headlights bounce off the puddles on the pavement, straining my eyes. It is 5:06 a.m. Soon the late spring sun will rise, but for now it is dark. The highway lit by streetlights in a stream of early morning commuters. I checked out of the motel, sacrificing the $100 security deposit in my haste to get away. I need to find Sean Sumner. And then I need to get on a plane. I am driving north, headed for Bellingham. The small city close to the Canadian border is an hour and a half's drive from Seattle. The halfway house is on the edge of town, in a stately old home. Inside are 20 men, struggling to rebuild lives destroyed by the crimes they have committed. They are offered support services, like drug and alcohol counseling, employment training, and anger management classes. But finding work, and eventually a place to live, is up to them. When the sun has risen and the city traffic thins, I pull into a drive-through coffee shop. I'm nervous to get out of my car, still worried someone could be watching me. But I need caffeine and some real food. Last night, I'd had chips from the vending machine for dinner, and my stomach is growling. I order a large coffee and a breakfast sandwich and move around to the pickup window. As I wait, I think about the man who answered the phone. The man who knew my name, who asked where I was. I know that I'm in danger now. There's no doubt. So why am I risking my safety to talk to Jesse's brother? What am I hoping to find? My thoughts are jumbled and fuzzy, from anxiety and lack of sleep. But I try to make sense of this trip. It might be natural curiosity pushing me north, the need to know more about the man I was involved with. The man who tricked me into believing he was someone honest and decent. Someone who really cared about me. The man who was very likely sleeping with my only friend. An affair that had gotten him killed. Or maybe I need to hear that, despite everything, Carter Sumner had a good side. Maybe I want Sean to tell me that his younger brother was a sweet boy once. Warm and caring and loving. that he made bad choices, that he got himself into trouble, but that the Jesse I knew had existed, that he'd wanted to start a new life, that what we had was real. And then I can grieve for him and let him go. It is not too late to turn back, to head directly to SeaTac Airport and get on that plane, to forget about this messy chapter and start my life over. I'm jarred from my internal debate by a teenage boy who leans out the window and passes me my order. Setting the cup in the console and the sandwich in my lap, I leave the parking lot. As I approach the highway, I deliberate for less than a second, and then I take the highway ramp headed north. The coffee and sandwich fortify me, and the rain has ceased by the time I reach the first exit for Bellingham. Under a heavy gray sky, I wend my way through residential streets toward the halfway house. The directions are written on a slip of paper torn from Jesse's notebook, and my eyes dart from them to the road as I move deeper into suburbia. Do the people inside these quiet homes know about the 20 ex-cons living in their midst? Are they tolerant and supportive, believing everyone deserves a second chance? Or do they sign petitions, write letters to the city council, vandalize the property? Not in my backyard. I park directly across the street from the halfway house. It looks like a normal home, large but innocuous. The lack of personal touches, its only defining feature. The neighbors have hanging baskets of flowers, a tricycle on the porch, a pink flamingo planted in a flower bed. Sean Sumner's residence has nothing like this. It's a place to pass through on the way to a new life, or back to jail if you screw up. The dashboard clock reads 6:47 a.m. as I turn off the car. There is movement inside. The residents getting ready for their jobs in factories and kitchens, on the docks or in grocery stores. I sip the remains of my coffee, eyes glued to the front door, waiting for him to emerge. Will I even recognize Sean Sumner based on that one distant photo? Will he resemble Jesse in movement or mannerisms? Somehow, I feel sure I will know him. The first man to leave the house is African-American. The second, shortly after, is white, but too small and wiry to be Sean Sumner. The online photo had depicted a big man with a broken nose and piercing blue eyes. The next man who emerges could be Jesse's brother, but it's hard to tell. It's not until his icy blue gaze drifts over my car that I know it's him. Before I lose my nerve, I scramble out of the vehicle. "Sean," I call, crossing the street toward him. He turns, those cold eyes landing on me, but he says nothing. "Can I talk to you for a second?"
"I have work,"
he continues down the street. "It's about your brother," I call after him, hoping that he'll turn around, talk to me, but he just keeps going. It's heartless to blurt it out like this, but I'm going to lose him. "Carter is dead." Sean Sumner stops. I see his shoulders rise in a deep, heavy breath. Slowly, he turns around and moves back toward me.
"He can't be dead,"
he says, stopping a few feet away from me.
"I'd be notified."
"I saw his body with my own eyes," I say, and my voice wobbles a little. "Carter was murdered." A muscle twitches in Sean's jaw, the only sign that he has registered what I am saying, but I seize on it. "I'll buy you a coffee," I offer, "and tell you everything I know." He glances at his cheap watch, and his internal debate plays out on his face. He's torn between his sense of duty and his curiosity, the need for information about his dead brother.
"Okay,"
he mutters. Curiosity wins. I knew it would.
If you want to listen to the entire part 3 of this story, sign up on Apple Podcasts and experience the full magic of this captivating tale.